Thank you very much, Craig.
Very much.
So, as Graham mentioned, I'm very pleased to be here at Ohio State CMRS because this is the first talk I'm giving on my recently published book. And it was here close to 10 years ago that I gave my first talk on my book project. And it was a result of this that I then published my first article on my project on balance in a book edited by Barbara and Lisa. So this is an important place for me. And I thank all of you for being here today, with a special thanks to Graham for inviting me to talk to you and for that very, very nice introduction. I'm going to read today because I have a lot to say. But I have a lot of words to say. And I think the only way I'm going to actually get through this is if I read. I'll try and read as expressively as I possibly can. So my presentation today is really from my most recent book, the title of which Graham mentioned, A History of Balance. And in this book, I try to show the extent to which preoccupations with balance lay at the core of four scholastic disciplines: medieval economic thought, medieval medical theory, political thought, and scholastic natural philosophy. And throughout, I argue that the changing models of balance which were assumed and applied within these four disciplines, and I emphasize changing, played a crucial role in shaping their development. And I argue further that the recognition and analysis of these changing models of balance can deepen our scholarly understanding of these disciplines and their developmental trajectories. In my talk today, I hope to provide evidence for yet other assertions, all of which I put forward in my book, that balance has a history, that between approximately 1280 and 1360, a manifestly new sense of balance and its potentialities emerged and evolved within the upper levels of university speculation, that this new sense of balance served as the ground of speculation in multiple and widely varying disciplines, and that therefore changes in the sense and imagination of what might constitute balance had the effect of opening up striking new vistas of imaginative and speculative possibility. So I think that balance is really pretty darn important. Countless words and concepts have changed over time and can be said to have a history. I'm very aware of that. But balance, I want to suggest, is different. Even in our common understanding today, balance is tied to a generalized and mostly unconscious sense. It's experienced as an unworded feeling for how objects and spaces are or ought to be arranged, or as an apprehension of how things properly fit together and work together in the world. Our recognition that the sense of balance is natural to humans tends to encourage a biological and hence essentialist understanding of it. Balance is balance. We all know what we mean by it. We all trust our sense of it. We never imagine that it is changing or even can change, and we certainly never think of ourselves as agents of its change. This is not only true today. It was the case with every thinker I consider in my book, even as I assign them an active role in the project of reshaping balance and reimagining its potentialities. What I found, however, is that in addition to whatever may be natural about the sense of balance, it is also historically specific. Under certain cultural conditions, new forms of balance can and have emerged. And my subject today is the specific form or model of balance that emerged and took shape between the late 13th and mid 14th century. Having made these preliminary claims, I want to quickly add that the Latin word balance, bilancia, and its close relative, equilibrium, seldom appeared in medieval writings. And when they did, their meaning rarely transcended their original ties to the common mechanical scale, bilance, and the simple equality of two equally balanced weights, equilibrium, that the scale was designed to find and measure. In the medieval period, neither term had gained the metaphorical and mathematical breadth they enjoy today when we routinely speak of fields, systems, or multiple forces in balance or in equilibrium. In the absence of the word, or the Latin word balance, in the absence of the word balance, Latin thinkers used a cluster of related terms to convey many of the meanings we attach to balance today. At the center of this cluster was the word equality, equalitas. We're going to hear that word many times today. And its cognates, equalis, equus, equare, equivalentia, adequatio, and others. In addition to these words, other weighty concepts were harnessed to this near universal concern. Among these were justitia, equitas, temperantia, symmetria, and mediatas. Now, while the words and terms expressing the ideal of balance equalitas held firm throughout the medieval period, I found that the spoken and unspoken meanings attached to these words changed profoundly, with a dramatic shift occurring over the period 1280 to 1360. The ideal of balance and its association with what is ordered, just, fitting, and healthful remained unchanged. The central place allotted to balance in the structure and activity of the cosmos remained unchanged. What changed within the culture of scholasticism was the range of possibilities and potentialities attached to the sense of what balance is and what balance can be. Despite the central place that the concern for balance held within medieval thought, or perhaps because of its very centrality, it was almost never brought to the fore as a subject of discussion in itself. Rather than serving as a recognizable subject of thought, balance acted as the unworded but pervasive ground of thought. And as such, it exercised its great influence beneath the surface of verbal expression, or conscious verbal expression, and beneath the surface of conscious recognition. But that didn't weaken or lessen it in any way. Rather, the sense of its presence or absence in large measure determined the judgment of what is right or wrong, what is ordered or disordered, what is helpful or dangerous. And indeed, I want to suggest that in the role it plays as the ground of thought, the sense of balance in large measure determines, and in this period determined, both the possibilities and the limits of what could be imagined, envisioned, comprehended, and thought. The problem is how to talk about and describe the changes in this unworded sense. Now, although my primary intent is to link the history of balance to the history of ideas, it's clear that balance in the medieval period cannot be thought of or treated as an idea, or even as a concept, since its definition was never problematized or communicated directly and intentionally from thinker to thinker. But even though it remained unworded, I've found that this complex and compound sense possessed a high degree of internal cohesion and coherence, a coherence sufficient to allow it to be recognized and identified as a particular and definable model. And I use that term a lot throughout my book, with the understanding that under certain circumstances, new models of balance can and do emerge to supplant, or at least to complement, earlier models. Just as the word balance has both a passive meaning, which is to say the equalized end or state of a process, and an active meaning, that is, the process of attaining that end, so too the word equalitas carried both a passive and an active sense in the medieval period. For that reason, I designate the desired state of balance in scholastic thought, the model of equality, and I designate the processes through which the state might be achieved and maintained, the model of equalization, with the understanding that the two models are very closely intertwined. The way I've come to see it, there was one dominant model of equality and equalization over the period circa 1225 to 1275. Which had been shaped by the most innovative and influential scholastic thinkers following the integration of Aristotle's writings into scholastic thought. And in my book, I use Albertus Magnus and Thomas Aquinas as typifying this older model of equality and equalization. Then in the last decades of the 13th century, a new way of modeling equality and equalization began to emerge within university culture that was strikingly different in form, composition, and effect from all previous medieval models. For reasons I outline in my book, this new model of equalization is the first that merits being characterized at the same time as a model of equilibrium. So what then are the major characteristics of this new model of equilibrium, and how do these differ from those comprising all previous medieval models? In my book's introduction, I isolate and list more than 20 of its distinguishing elements. But rather than go through this whole list, here I'm going to only name a few of them in the hopes of providing you with some sense of the nature, shape, and particularity of this new model, as I designate it. So, in the new model, one, balance comes to be viewed as an aggregate product of systematic activity. And what by that I mean, where formerly balance had been viewed as a precondition of existence, built into nature in the Aristotelian scheme or instilled into creation by a creating God, now the focus shifted to the visualization and exploration of complex functioning systems in which balance, equalitas, was produced through the systematic interaction of multiple moving parts within the whole. Two, and by the way, I'm numbering these just to separate them. They're all intertwined. It's very hard. It's impossible for me to grade them. Don't take these numbers in any sense a grading of these in importance. Two, within the functioning whole, faith in the systematic process of interior self-ordering and self-equalizing replaces the need for an active orderer or overarching ordering intelligence. Perhaps you can see the implications of that. Three, aggregation, externalization, and depersonalization come to characterize systematic analysis. Four, relational thinking replaces hierarchical thinking. Five, lines replace points, fluidity replaces fixity, and concern with the details of motion and change replaces the search for essences and perfections. Six, the underlying mathematics moves from addition and subtraction to multiplication, and at the same time, from integers into the realm of exponential powers. Seven, probability is fully acknowledged, and probabilistic reasoning is employed. I'm coming to the end. So, eight, good function becomes a primary consideration, and by that I mean the capacity of the system simply to work and to work well, which in this case implies its capacity to maintain itself in balance, equalitas, is taken in itself as a sign of its positive value without reference to its capacity to work toward ends that conform to traditional or hierarchical ideals. Indeed, as I hope we'll see in my talk today, the recognition that a system works well compels, in certain cases, the reevaluation of traditional beliefs and ideals that the system either ignores or transgresses. And finally, nine, the new model of balance is differentiated from harmony, and I'll speak to that specifically. So what I hope to convey through this abridged listing is how complex and many-faceted models of balance can be and how utterly intertwined their elements are. And when a cluster of elements link to form a meaning web of such complexity and reflectivity, its weight and potential impact is multiplied far beyond the sum of its parts. It becomes more than a collection. It becomes, in medieval terms, a unity, unitas, which is to say a cohesive working whole. That's the way the term is used in medical, in Avicenna, Latin translations of Avicenna and commentaries on Avicenna. It possesses a characteristic feel, a characteristic motion, and a characteristic rhythm, which can be sensed and experienced. And it is the sensual and experiential presence, I surmise, that allows models of balance their remarkable power in the realm of ideas. In my book, I argue that each of the elements listed above, taken both singly and as parts of an interconnected and integrated unity, underlay, indeed actively directed, the most innovative speculations that appeared across widely varying intellectual disciplines over the period 1280 to 1360. Those who had intuited and could apply the new model could see things, imagine things, and speculate on things that those who had not could not. That many of the elements constituting the new model of equalization differed markedly from those that had constituted all previous models adds further to the importance of pursuing a history of balance rather than merely considering balance in terms of its basis in biology or brain function. At the same time, it raises the question, given that the subject of balance itself was almost never explicitly recognized or debated within the intellectual culture of scholasticism, how does a change of this magnitude occur? As I've come to see them, new models are generated in three distinct yet mutually reinforcing ways. Just to summarize, one way is through the scholar's intellectual apprehension and internalization of forms of equalization embedded in authoritative texts, since the concern for balance goes all the way back. In my book, I focus on two of these areas. First, the texts of Aristotle, and particularly the Physics and the Ethics and the Politics. Of course, there's no surprise here. But what did surprise me was finding that the medical writings of Galen of Pergamum from the second century CE and the remarkably complex and dynamic modeling of bodily equalitas that appears everywhere in these writings may well have had the most profound textual impact on the formation of the new model of equilibrium that I've located to the late 13th century. A second way the model is shaped is through the scholar's participation in an intellectual culture. Within such cultures, the assumptions that underlie the model may never be the subject of conscious analysis or debate, but they are nevertheless open to being sensed or intuited by the deepest and most sensitive readers and thinkers through the mutual exchange of texts and insights within an intellectual culture. And the universities of Bologna or Padua or Montpellier or Oxford and Paris in the later 13th and 14th centuries provide excellent examples of such intellectual cultures. A third way the model is shaped is through the scholar's daily interactions with environments that functioned in effect as concrete social forms of equilibrium. Important among these are the economic structures of the marketplace, the political structures of the civitas, and the social, physical, and technological environment of the living city itself, in which these scholars were immersed, whether at Padua, Montpellier, Oxford, Paris. Within these environments, all of which, by the way, were described at the time as forms of equilibrium, strangely but interestingly, personal success and well-being was tied, then as now, to the scholar's capacity to comprehend their logic, to sense and intuit their rhythms, and to adjust to their ever-evolving structures and demands. So I want to suggest that the construction of models of equality and equalization out of these three distinct yet interwoven shaping influences, one primarily textual, one primarily intuitive, and one primarily experiential, renders them uniquely suited to mediate between environment and intellectual invention, between unconscious sense and conscious science. But the question is, of course, how do you define the model structure when it was never explicitly discussed or described, when in all probability it was never consciously grasped, even by the subjects who were employing it? And granted, there are great difficulties to this project. But I want to suggest that the model's very unconsciousness, I'm making a pitch here, I want to suggest that the model's very unconsciousness may well render it a more fruitful subject for historical inquiry than intellectual contents that are fully conscious and made explicit in texts. The fact that models of balance are not consciously shaped and presented, not colored and tailored to fit a set of normative expectations, allows them considerable advantages as markers of thought. Moreover, their lack of verbal expression doesn't diminish their directive force. On the contrary, the direct identification of a qualitas with what is helpful and what is productive, and inequalitas with the unhealthy and destructive, is nearly universal, even though balance remains unworded, and even as the sense of what actually constitutes balance is open to change over time. And finally, the existence of models of equality and equalization beneath the level of verbal expression is precisely what makes possible their presence in every culture. And as a result, their potential, and I stress that, comparability across cultures. This really does interest me. One of the great advantages I see to bringing models of balance to the center of the history of ideas is the potential it creates for comparative studies of intellectual development across different disciplines, periods, and cultures. So much for the general background. In the time remaining, I'd like to first go into some detail concerning the factors that shape the new model of equilibrium, and then in the last part of the paper, to consider what the possession of this new model made possible in the realm of thought. Having time to discuss only one of the many shaping factors, I've chosen to focus in the area of scholastic economic theory, since I suspect that in every culture and every period, dominant forms of economic exchange shape the cultural modeling of balance on the deepest level, and I would extend that into the present day. One of the striking characteristics of scholastic economic thinking is that it's centered on the proposition that equalitas is the required end of all exchange. In line with this proposition, both in the scholastic discourse on usury that I consider in my first chapter, and in the discourse on price and value, which I talk about in my second chapter, writers universally identified the process of economic exchange as a process of equalization, which is to say, a process directed toward achieving a just balance between exchangers. And at the same time that they'll use the word equalitas, they'll very often use the image of the scale. This remained the case despite huge advances over these centuries in the economic areas of monetization, commercialization, and urbanization, as we all know. But even as the ideal of equalitas continued to hold firm, the spoken and unspoken meanings attached to this ideal changed profoundly. The persistence of the usury prohibition in scholastic economic thought is often taken as a sign that medieval churchmen were ignorant, and even willfully ignorant, of the details of economic life in their society. The truth is much more interesting. The early solidification of the church's condemnation of usury and the ever-increasing sense of danger and sin that attached to usurious acts had the effect of forcing scholastic legal scholars, moralists, and theologians, including sitting popes, to become expert in the ways of the marketplace. Only this way could they hope to recognize usurious transactions and to root them out. Those clerics who undertook this task were gradually brought to recognize, and more often, which is even stranger, to accept that economic life functions according to its own rules and principles. Principles that were often distinct from, if not at odds with, oft-stated principles governing the Christian life. They came to recognize that economic truths are at best provisional and approximative rather than absolute. That economic value is shifting and relativized rather than ordered to any recognizable hierarchy. That economic judgment functions around risks and probabilities rather than certainties. And despite their recognition of these dichotomies, and many, many more, I could list them for a whole page, theologians and canon lawyers remained confident that they could carry the ideal of equalitas into the marketplace as the essential test of licit exchange. As an unintended consequence, the equalitas that emerged from its immersion in the marketplace in the second half of the 13th century was far, far different from the Equalitas that had entered it a century and a half earlier. The ever-multiplying speed, volume, and complexity of commercial and market exchange over these centuries, these years, had the unintended effect of continually pressuring, reshaping, and stretching the definitional bounds of Equalitas. In my book, I follow this stretching and reshaping over a number of steps in the economic sphere, beginning with Gracian, beginning with the Decretum and Gracian's analysis of usury in the Decretum, all the way to the writing of the Franciscan theologian Peter of John Olivi at the end of the 13th century. In the time I have today, I'm going to present a very highly pixelated picture of this very long process, beginning with Gracian and then jumping 150 years to Olivi. So the Decretum was the first canon law collection to devote an entire question to the definition of usury. In every authoritative position in the loan contract that Gracian cites, there's a striking simplicity and uniformity to the model of equality that he's applying, that he assumes. The sum the lender demands in return for the loan must be precisely equal to the sum lent. Five solidi requires five solidi in return, and not a fraction of a penny more. And they're very, very intent on arguing this. Each side of the loan equation is presumed to be numerable, perfectly knowable, and perfectly fixed once known. It's a model of equality based on the literal and original meaning of the word equilibrium, the balancing of perfectly equal weights by means of a mechanical scale. The slightest arithmetical inequality represents an imbalance, superabundantia, which is at the same time a violation of equalitas and a sin against the divine order. There's no sense in the Decretum that the loan contract is embedded in personal or social or spatial or temporal context that could affect its outcome in any way. There's no consideration of the circumstances of the participants. No consideration that the lender and borrower might gain or lose differentially through the exchange. And not only the participants are imagined as innocent of context, economic value itself, along with a numbered coin, is assumed to be fixed, perfectly measurable, and fully knowable. In the century following Gracian's treatment of usury, between 1150 and 1250, virtually every one of these economic assumptions underwent profound change. Then between 1250 and 1300, they underwent an even more drastic change, as far as I can see. And changing right alongside them were the assumptions concerning what actually constitutes equalitas, what actually constitutes a just balance between exchangers. The pressures driving the redefinition of economic equality, I think I might skip this paragraph because I can see I'm running late. So let me jump to Peter of John Olivi. Oh, one step before Olivi. But we all know about that this is a very vibrant economic period. And so you can imagine that the pressures on these earlier definitions, how strong they might have been. By the 1270s, in response to the same pressures that reshaped equalitas in the scholastic discourse on usury, a similar but even more destabilized vision of exchange equality was emerging within the discourse of contracts of sale. Faced with the continuing question of what might satisfy the requirement for equality between buyer and seller, not lender and borrower, but at the same time recognizing the actual complexities of exchange contracts in the heated economic environment of his day, Godfrey of Fontaine was one of a number of theologians who were coming to a fascinating conclusion.